coming up, my thoughts from NBA All-Star Weekend here in Los Angeles. Ben Golliver talking about tanking teams in the NBA, and then Cedric Howard from the Memphis Grizzlies. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. I'm here in LA. All-Star Weekend just wrapped up. I got Ben Golliver on the show later today talking about tanking around the NBA. Cedric Howard from the Memphis Grizzlies as well, breaking down the first half of his season. But right now, we're going to start off with seven of my thoughts from All-Star Weekend, starting off with the new format. It's a big win. This is a big win. Shorter games, more urgency, having three teams, the two American teams, the Stars and the Stripes, and the World team. I don't even think it was necessarily this format with World and the USA teams. It could have been pick'em teams. It could have been old versus young, which it sort of was with the Stars and Stripes. It could have been captains. It didn't matter. Having three teams or four teams or however many you want to in future years, there is urgency in these games. We saw it in game one. Wemby set the tone. Anthony Edwards said it after the game. Wemby set the tone. Game one, he was playing hard. He had three blocks in 12 minutes. He was disappointed after the game, after Karl Anthony Towns botched a rotation when they were up in the game and they couldn't give up a three, and Cat left open a shooter, Scottie Barnes, to lose that first game. And Wemby's frustrated. He was complaining, trying to get fouls, busting his butt the whole game. I thought that set the tone. Anthony Edwards came out in game two, end of that game, the way he defended Donovan Mitchell, getting a steal, scoring five straight points. They lost the game to a De'Aaron Fox game winner, but of course they end up winning the tournament. It just seemed like all of these games were competitive, except for the last one. The Stripes ran out of energy, the old team there, but I'm impressed. I think this is a good format. I hope the NBA continues it. I don't think they need to commit to USA versus World, but I think continuing this in Phoenix a year from now with three teams or four teams in a similar format, this is a good thing. It made the games more competitive. There was more urgency, and I'd go with three or four captains. That's what I'd like to see happen, but ultimately, I'm happy with what the NBA did. Number two thought here, it's time for the NBA to demote the old guard and promote the new guard. It's kind of symbolic that the American star team actually won this over the Stripes. The Stripes were the old team with LeBron James and Kevin Durant, and Steph Curry wasn't playing, but he was on that squad as well. The Stars, Anthony Edwards wins MVP. He was a tone setter tonight in the All-Star game. Tyrese Maxey, Devin Booker, Cade Cunningham, Jalen Duren, Scottie Barnes with that big shot at the end of the first game against the World team, Chet Holmgren, Jalen Johnson. These aren't all the young players that we're talking about in the NBA, but I've been thinking about it a lot. It's been a conversation I've had with people around the league as well. The NBA, they love scheduling Warriors and Lakers and LeBron and Steph and all these stars that we've had in our life for over a decade. Since many of us were kids, we've had these players in our lives, and it's great that we have this generation still in the NBA, but Anthony Edwards is box office, and some of these young guys are players that I think could really attract fans worldwide and nationwide here in the United States. And I would hope that the NBA sees what happened with these stars, the Stars team, the literal Stars team, winning this tournament, the way they play, the energy they bring to the floor, the style of play they have. I mean, Anthony Edwards is like, you can't take your eyes off the TV when you watch him play on either end of the floor, especially when he's trying on defense. It should be reflected in the promotion of the game. It should be reflected in the scheduling for national TV games. I think the NBA, they almost got scared off the year they put the Pelicans on national TV a bunch of times and Zion got hurt. Zion is a bust in terms of the star power aspect, but the idea of promoting a young player, go for it. And I think a lot of these players that we saw in this game tonight, All-Star Weekend, the NBA needs to invest in them even more so moving forward. And that's not to say you dump, you know, LeBron James and Stephen Curry. I'm not saying that. Those guys are still high-level players. But maybe make a little space for this new generation. Number three, Saturday night needs an overhaul. I mean, as good as Sunday was, Saturday night was still horrible. So was Friday night, for that matter. I've never been a fan of Friday night. But Saturday, I grew up, as I'm sure many of you did listening or watching this podcast, loved Saturday night. I loved the dunk contest. I loved the three-point contest. I loved all of it. And it just feels dead. It feels dead. I kind of respect the NBA bringing in all these influencers, you know, because you're attracting a younger audience, a younger demographic. I get the mindset with doing that. Seeing Drewski passing the ball on the shooting stars drill is kind of absurd. I just don't get it. Why do we need Drewski or Anthony Anderson out there, all these guys? It doesn't make any sense to me, but I think you can have the influencers without doing that. But it's not just that. It's like the three-point shooting contest. Too many money balls, too many bonus balls. It's confusing. Can we just count the makes? Just count the makes and the misses. And Keshawn Johnson winning the dunk contest. I mean, he's a who he play for player. It's just the honest truth. Like, we can't get VJ Edgecombe in this. You know, we can't get a rookie, a possible star. You can't talk him into it. I just, like, you got to figure out a way to make the dunk contest more appealing. Maybe it has to be a more significant cash prize, but you also need new competitions. The three-point shooting contest needs to improve. The shooting stars is wasteful. It's a waste of time, just being honest. What we really need is a one-on-one tournament for All-Star Weekend. The NBA needs to find a way to make a one-on-one tournament happen. I don't care if it's a cash prize. I don't care how significant it is. You got to make it happen. They tried making this happen in Unrivaled with women's players. They got to try to make it happen with men's players in the NBA. We need to see Anthony Edwards versus Victor Wembanyama. Big versus less big in Anthony Edwards. We need to see these different styles of play with some strict rules to figure it out and make it exciting for fans. Obviously, players don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want to lose 5-0 or 11-0 or whatever you have as a score. But that is what would bring Saturday night back. And so the NBA needs to find a way to make that happen moving forward, hopefully starting next year in Phoenix. Number four thought from All-Star Weekend. And at one point, I thought this might be the leading topic. And it still sort of is in a way. Number four, Adam Silver is under pressure. I can't think of a time in the whole Adam Silver era that he's been under more pressure than we've seen on social media in recent days and on radio airwaves and in your AirPods listening to podcasts. Why now, though, is my question. Are we seeing so much pressure on Adam Silver? People questioning if he's the right commissioner, if he's right for the job, if he's the guy that can turn things around. Why now? Tanking is not new. This has been around for a long time now. All-Star Weekend sucking is not new. It's been a drag for a while. The regular season lull, this is not new. This has been around a long time now. So I've just been thinking, why now? Is it so loud on social media with people questioning Adam Silver? And I'm not saying it's wrong to question Silver. Nobody's perfect. No leader's perfect in any realm, any league. He's flawed. He's too cozy with the players. You can say he's soft. You can say he caters too much to the players. You can say he's too much of a collaborator and he needs to be a more authoritative leader, more like David Stern. You can say all those things, and I don't necessarily disagree with all of them. My thought here is, though, it's good that Adam Silver's under pressure, because pressure is where you find out sometimes who you really are, who a leader really is. That's where you find out what a player is when it's 3 seconds left in the game and they're under pressure and they need to make a decision. That's when you find out who a leader is, when they have to make tough decisions under pressure. And so I'm actually excited to see what Adam Silver does here. I thought his press conference on Saturday, he didn't necessarily give us answers to anything in terms of what's going to happen with tanking or expansion. And we'll talk about some of that in a minute, but the one thing I've always liked about Adam Silver is his willingness to experiment and try different things. And like Cade Cunningham had a quote this weekend about how he wishes the All-Star game was still East versus West, like, because that's what he grew up watching. Well, that degraded into an unwatchable product. And that's why they've experimented with all these different things, with the target score, now with the teams, the player, people picking their own players, Durant as a captain and LeBron and Giannis and all that, like we saw a few years back. And now they're doing the thing with USA versus World with three teams. They're trying things. I've appreciated Adam Silver with the play-in tournament and the NBA Cup and trying things. Because the NBA in the 90s and the early 2000s is not what the NBA is in the world today with all the content out there. The NBA is competing against literally everything out there. And so they have to try things to spice things up and keep things fresh. Other leagues do this too. Baseball did this with the pitch clock. They did this with the size of the bases. We see this with the NFL with all their rule changes and everything as well. They experiment. And so now that Adam is feeling pressure and getting criticized more than ever, I can't wait to see the way he responds because we're about to find out who Adam Silver really is. And with his experimentation willingness, I feel some sense of optimism that Silver is going to pull some strings here and hopefully make things even better for us in the NBA moving forward to take advantage of the great players we have. And I thought these players were on display this weekend, and hopefully, you know, that we can improve things in the NBA moving forward, including with tanking. Number five, the tanking rules are going to change. The lottery rules are going to change, whatever you want to call them. So last week on my podcast, I reported that the NBA has considered changing protections, perhaps allowing teams to only protect picks 1-4 or 1-14 to eliminate teams like Utah or Washington feeling the need to tank to protect top picks from 1-8, for example. Or they could freeze the date, maybe a February 1st date or a March 1st date, that the NBA could keep that a secret. Joe Vardon over at The Athletic wrote an article about how this week the NBA discussed 10 solutions to potentially changing the tanking rules. And he did say, even though, you know, he got aggregated in a way that was very inaccurate, you may have seen that people said that abolishing the draft wasn't ruled out. Vardon wrote in his story that abolishing the draft wasn't discussed as an option. It's the opposite. It's just that if everything else failed, the NBA wouldn't rule that out. But they're not going to go there now. It's just like it's not even on the table. But the fact is that from the conversations I've had this weekend with people here and with people just over the phone, it does seem like the league is going to make changes this summer. And until then, as Adam kind of hinted at, they're just going to try to do things to deter teams from tanking the remainder of the season, which is why we saw the Pacers and the Jazz already fined. Number six, expansion back on the board. It seems like it was away dead for a little bit of while now. Adam Silver at his press conference said the Board of Governors meeting in March will discuss expansion. They will not vote on it yet. Adam didn't commit to two teams, Seattle and Vegas being the teams everybody considers most likely, and that's true. I think Adam's being genuine when he says it might not be two teams. This has been consistent in conversations I've had with league office folks for a long time now. It could just be one team. It won't necessarily be two. So I think that's what that Board of Governors meeting will be really getting into. Is it going to be one team or two teams they want to add once they expand? Or do they want to have a wave of it, one now and then one in X amount of years later? So we'll see there. What's clear, again, as Adam Silver talked about, conference realignment would be something that happens. And I'm sure maybe we'll see Minnesota with Anthony Edwards move out east when they eventually do add a team in X amount of years. Thought number seven, Los Angeles as a host city. Got a lot of different feedback from people over this weekend. A lot of people complaining about how spread out everything is. It takes 45 minutes to go everywhere. Other people talking about how it's great with all the different events and the places to go. I lived in LA before. I'm used to the distance of places. And for me, I like LA as a host city, personally. I know everything's spread out, but I think if you're a fan visiting here in LA, there's something here for everybody, no matter where you're staying. And I was happy being back here for the weekend. I had a good time doing some things I used to do when I lived out here. And from people I talked to that did enjoy it, I think for the most part, feedback is positive. It's just about game planning. You get to call your Waymo or your Uber at the right time and know you're going to have 30 or 40 minutes in traffic. Use that time to your advantage. Take a phone call. relax, shut your eyes, whatever it is. Like, you make the most of your time, no matter the situation in your life. I like LA as a host city. At the same time, I'm glad they don't do it in the same place every year. I'm excited for Phoenix next year. I think it's going to be great there. They get their arena. It's a smaller city. It's a cool city. So I'm very excited for Phoenix next year. That's a long time away from now. The NBA could look totally different a year from now. We still have a whole second half of the season to come. To talk about that, today on the show, I got Cedric Coward from the Memphis Grizzlies. Stick around for that. We broke down his game, got into a bunch of players around the league. It's not just a conversation for Grizzlies fans. So I hope you enjoy that podcast conversation later with Cedric Coward. But first, we got Ben Golliver from The Greatest of All Talk, his longtime NBA show, him and Andrew Sharp. Got Golliver on, first-time guest here on the show. We recorded this here in the studio here in Los Angeles, breaking down the tanking teams in the NBA. Why is tanking going on? What's the league going to do about it? And what's one thing to watch for from all nine tanking teams in the NBA in the second half of the year? That's coming up right now, me and Ben Golliver. Joining me to discuss the NBA tanking all around the league right now is Ben Golliver from The Greatest of All Talk. Ben, how are you?
Doing very well, man. It's an epidemic, right?
It absolutely is. It's happening everywhere. We got eight or nine teams, basically a third of the league tanking right now. Today, we're going to go through one thing to watch for in the second half of the year with every tanking team. Starting off, I mean, we probably should start with Utah or Indiana. We'll alternate our picks here with where we want to go, but Utah got fined $500K. Indiana got fined $100K. So where do you want to start, Ben?
Well, what did they do wrong? Obviously, they're pulling guys out mid-game, essentially. They're like kind of fourth quarter tanking, if you want to put it that way, taking their best players off the court.
Even though they're 2-1, Utah is.
Right. And so this is like a new barrier or boundary for tanking. I mean, we've seen teams for years shut down players, you know, just come up with illnesses, come up with injuries. But this is like within the middle of a game, it feels anti-competitive. So Adam Silver came out with a pretty strong statement. I don't know what you saw, but I saw a really interesting backlash from the Jazz. I mean, we saw Ryan Smith on Twitter, you know, kind of commenting, pushing back on the fine and going after some of the commentators who had criticized his team. We saw the fan base. No one's denying that they're doing it. They're just saying, hey, don't fine us. Everyone's been doing this for years. Toronto shut down guys early last year. So why do we have to be the team that's getting fined? And so what I want to see as the rest of this season unfolds, do they take it to other places? Do they get even more creative? Are they not just resting guys maybe in the fourth quarter? They're changing rotations. They're shortening minutes. They're playing cat and mouse and really trying to stick to the plan, which is we've got to keep our draft pick, but also trying to avoid the fines, of course, too. So I feel like this story is just getting started. Usually you get $500K, and you know Adam Silver is probably going to come out at All-Star Weekend and really lay the hammer down and say we can't have this in the league. But we all know it's not going away, right? So I'm watching the Jazz for their tanking innovation. They're taking it to new heights already. I think they can go even higher.
I think similarly with Indiana, right? So all year long, the Pacers stink. They're 15-40 on the year. Last year, they had a plus 1.1 net rating in minutes without Halliburton.
Right.
This year, they're absolutely horrific, obviously. So what's going on here? Is this just, is Carlisle forgotten how to coach? Well, no. I mean, I remember with the Pacers, I think you'll see the Jazz do stuff like this as well. The Pacers in a mid-December game, they're like 5 wins in. I think they had 20 losses or something like that. Middle of December, I'm watching a Pacers-Knicks game. And this is where it was like just locked in. I was like, oh, it is clear as day. This team has no interest in winning, no interest in turning their season around. It's the middle of December. It's over. Carlisle played like 12 guys in a game against the Knicks, a 1-point loss. Right. And it was like Garrison Matthews and Johnny Furphy for like a 7-minute stretch. And they get blown out like 16 points in that stretch. Whereas like it was, I think, a big Mathurin game or a big Nembhard game, a big Siakam game. And they were all like plus 20 against the Knicks. And I was like, this team has no interest in winning games this year. And I have the same questions with the Pacers. How innovative are they going to get?
Right.
Rick Carlisle, the master of tanking. What is he going to do? Because we already know the Jazz and the Pacers have been made an example of. They are under the microscope. So how creative are these teams going to get to continue trying to lose games? Indiana's won 2 in a row.
Well, here's the thing, though. I mean, look, the competitive integrity of the NBA is a loser within this tank conversation. Winners G League call-ups, like you're talking about, guys who can sneak in and get some minutes towards the end of the season, and also orthopedic surgeons. I mean, that's the other thing I forgot to mention with the Utah Jazz. Had you ever heard of this Jaren Jackson Jr. knee injury that he's going to get? I mean, it was like three sentences just to explain what the procedure was, and he was playing fine just last week, right? So creative surgery.
My understanding
surgeries.
On that is, like, it is definitely a creative surgery. My understanding is that it's like, it's preventative.
Yeah.
It's something that can, it is growing and it can cause swelling and soreness and further issues down the line. So,
well,
timing wise, could they wait till the offseason to do it? Probably.
I'm saying if you go to the doctor and you're saying, I'm looking to get a surgery, he can come up with one for you. You know, it's, we could all have preventative surgeries all day long. So that's what I'm saying. There's, you know, there's some winners here within this mix. I think the sports medical industry will be just fine taking on new clients, and we'll see how it goes.
I definitely look forward to seeing what those two teams do, because it's not going to stop. With Indiana, it's interesting, though. They traded their pick this year protected.
Yeah.
It's protected like 1-4 and then 10-30. So it's like if it falls 5-9, it'll go to the LA Clippers. So they have incentive to tank, to increase their odds.
They cannot win another game. They have to, they have
to. They've won two in a row, Ben.
Yeah, not good. If that momentum continues, could you see them trying to secure the 10 part of that, you know, because there's going to be a lot of other teams, as we're going to discuss, trying to lose. Do you try to kind of go the other way with it? You have to stay in the bottom four.
That'd be bad news.
Yeah.
The AJ Nibanta, Cam Boozer, Darren Peterson, even Caleb Wilson, throw him in there from North Carolina. These are the jewels of the draft.
Yeah.
These are the pieces that could be franchise changers. There could be very good players available at 10. There might be a guy who becomes an all-star, an all-NBA player. You never know. Like, that happens every year. There's always a guy in the 10 to 14 range, the SGA types, who become superstars. But the fact is that, like, the guys that you want are the top three picks.
Well, look, I mean, I definitely...
That's why they protected it, Ben.
No,
that's why.
100%. But, you know, I do wonder, like, it's kind of interesting to me. You know, the last guy who was a number one overall pick, who wound up being the best player on a championship team, LeBron James in 2003. You go back the last 20-something years, this idea that you're automatically going to get a franchise player who's going to put you on the right course, it's almost a guaranteed no-brainer. Like, if you're a bad team, you have to tank because this is the smart thing to do. It doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes you get stuck with Ben Simmons. Sometimes you get stuck with Zion Williamson. Sometimes you get stuck with Markelle Fultz. And, you know, those are, in some cases, really expensive mistakes, too. So I understand why teams do it, but I do think there's other ways to try to build your team rather than just gutting it to the bottom. Now, of course, Indiana... Halliburton's out of the mix. You understand their motivations would change. You know, for Utah, like, I like that they traded for Jaren Jackson Jr. Be honest, I wanted to watch him play alongside Larry Markin and just see what it kind of looks like for all four quarters and not just the first three. And instead, you know, they're going to pull these shenanigans. I just wonder, like, they have a good young coach in Will Hardy. Feels like he's getting kneecapped. You know, he's not able to do his job because, you know, they're saying, hey, we got to play for these picks. Is it really in the best interest of that organization to pursue it the way that they're going? I'm not totally convinced. Obviously, you need the high-level picks at some point to get talent that's better than what they have, right? But, you know, trying to go all out for the number one pick, it's not a guarantee. I mean, we've seen it for 20-something years. You know, you're still flipping coins.
You're 100% right. And ultimately with the flattened odds as well.
Yeah.
We've seen 11 of the 28 picks in the 7 years that end up in the top four are teams that had seventh or worst odds.
Well, so have you ever been in the draft lottery room where they do that?
I went the Zion year. So that was the first year of the flattened odds.
So when the teams that think they're going to get the number one pick wind up with the number five pick, that is the saddest you're ever going to see. I mean, I think it happened to Houston, happened to Detroit, and just the deflation of a year completely squandered to get the fifth pick when you thought you were going to get the first pick. That's a big difference. So again, you know, the flat lottery odds, that's a question I wanted to ask you. Should they unflatten them? I mean, is that part of what's driving this? Is this idea of like, well, you know, we're not horrible, but we're bad. So we're kind of in the mix here. Whereas if you actually just had to be a terrible, terrible team and only a few teams could benefit from the lottery, maybe we wouldn't have nine teams to go through today.
I mean, I do think that we wouldn't have nine teams to go through. Yeah. I don't think you'd have teams like the Bulls or you know, the Bucks or whoever on the bubble, the Grizzlies feeling like, you know what, we got to really die out the rest of this year and lose a bunch of games to have a chance, because that's the issue. Like I said, seventh or worse odds. 11 of those teams have moved up in the last 7 years now, since 2019. 11 of them.
Yeah.
And it was the previous three decades where 11 teams moved into the top three, because it was the three picks drafted before instead of four. Teams feel like they just have to get into the middle. And so should you unflatten the odds? I think there needs to be different change if the objective is to get rid of tanking.
Yeah.
If the objective is to get rid of tanking and eliminate it, you need to go further. What is the league going to do? We'll see over time. I reported on my podcast last week how they've talked about changing pick protections, how setting a date where the standings freeze, and then that's when, you know, the lottery odds are set. Shams Charania reported on ESPN. They've talked about having a tournament between the lottery teams. The tournament is such a fun idea.
Yeah.
In theory, it would be great to see these lottery teams battling off for the number one pick. It's a horrible idea in reality. Teams are not going to compete for the number one pick. That works against the interests for a lot of players.
Yeah.
These teams are done already. They want to go to Cancun and start their vacations. Yeah. They're not gonna fight for it.
Yeah.
And so even if you do the type of thing where it's like after the standings are frozen, those games after start counting and nobody knows the date, people are still, I think,
they're just going to start tanking on day one.
They're going to start tanking on day one and try winning later. I think all those systems can be gamed.
Enough tournaments, okay? We've had enough tournaments. Yeah. We got the play-in tournament. We got the NBA Cup. We're good on tournaments. I don't think we need another one. I think the answer here, and Jazz fans don't want to hear this, I think public shame is the route. You know, I kind of like Adam Silver. Yeah, man, do it. You've got to get, fine them, you know, and start thinking about suspensions. You know, Adam Silver was hinting at, hey, competition committee could maybe have some, you know, greater sanctions. I think that it's just become too ingrained. You know, I understand the benefits of why teams do it, but, you know, this is becoming the chief storyline for All-Star Weekend. This is what everyone's talking about.
Isn't it whack-a-mole, though? If you're saying we're going to dock odds from the Jazz, let's just say that happens in April, they remove a 5% chance from Utah. How can you do that, but you can't do it to, say, Indiana? You need to do it to everybody.
Everybody. Let's get some tanking enforcement officers going around these teams and getting real serious. I mean, they talked about having the independent doctors from the league, basically, you know, confirming our players healthy or not. And that's what happened to Indiana, where their doctors looked at it, or the league's doctors, and said, hey, these guys are healthy. They need to be playing.
We'll see what happens with Zubas. And he's never injured in his whole career.
Right.
Suddenly he has an ankle injury that's forcing him to be sidelined. Okay.
I'm telling you, those doctors, man, if you want an elective surgery, they're going to give it to you. But I think that is the right approach. You know, it's like you obviously have to have league oversight. And I think one of the criticisms you could have of the league office is it's been so revenue generated focused, you know, in terms of how can we make more money for everyone else, and letting some of these big problems fester and fester and not really pushing back. I think in some cases, like criticism of the officials, that should be punished a lot harder than they are right now. Suspensions for fights, those could be stronger.
I think the ref should be fined.
Yeah, well, a lot of people do. But it's a tough job for those guys. I don't know. I would like to see a heavier hand from Adam Silver. And you don't have to go full David Stern. You know, there's probably a right way in the middle. But I don't think it's unhealthy to call out what these teams are doing and saying that it's not in the competitive spirit of sports, you know? Did you ever, when you were a kid, say, I want to get pulled in the fourth quarter because, we need to get, you know, some incentive six months from now? That's not how it goes.
It's not a good thing. I don't think tanking is good for anybody except for front offices who strategically decide that this is what we're going to do within the ecosystem that has been created for us. But that's the only reason why it's good. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for coaches. It's not good for
fans.
It's not good for fans to have to root for it. I mean, the fact is that there are Pacers fans who are like, we don't want to see Zubats until October.
I know.
You shouldn't, that shouldn't be a thought in your mind.
Right.
But that's the way it is. And I think we'll move on to the next team here, the Chicago Bulls. On my mind, is a tanking team. They've lost six in a row. They traded half their roster.
Yeah.
They have eight guards on their team right now. The question on my mind for the second half is, are Rob Dillingham and Leonard Miller NBA players?
Yeah.
They never got a great opportunity in Minnesota. Leonard Miller played 49 games in 3 years. He was a 25-11-4 guy in the G League his final year getting minutes in the G League. Rob Dillingham was pretty bad with the opportunities he got with the Timberwolves, but he never had consistent opportunity. The Bulls are going to give Dillingham consistent minutes. Miller will see. But that's the number one thing I'm watching for with the Bulls the remainder of the year. We're going to find out if those guys in now year three for Dillingham and for Miller as well, are these guys NBA players or not?
Well, you said they traded half their rosters, the tall half, right?
The tall half, yes. They're very small. Gershon Yabusele, like starting center.
Yeah, it's
crazy.
You're
going to find them for that?
talk about innovation. It's like, oh, we're going with the 6'3 and under. You know, it's a whole new approach, a great way to lose games. Yeah, can we add Jaden Ivey to this mix?
Yeah.
Is he an NBA player? Are we sure? I mean, is he good?
Is he a solid rotation guy or is he a star? Yeah. What is he?
I don't see star for sure. I mean, I don't know. I probably would have him on the, in the question mark category with some of these guys that you're mentioning. Dillingham, he was always on the outs in Minnesota, right? And he didn't get the opportunity because it felt like the trust wasn't there with the coaching staff. Totally different standard in Chicago. In Minnesota, the idea is like, hey, we have to go from very, very good to elite. We have to make that last step from getting Western Conference Finals to winning a championship, right? Very unlikely that the smallest guy on the court, the youngest guy on the team, is going to be that person who boosts you up, right? Well, Chicago is a completely different environment. It should be fun to watch. But to be honest, I look at their roster. There's not a lot of those guys that I like. No. You know, I mean, it's worth watching down the stretch to see if somebody does pop in a new way. But it seemed like they just kind of traded for a whole bunch of guys who can't really play.
Who do you have on your list next?
So I have the Milwaukee Bucks. It's another one of these like big picture question marks. Like what's the direction? So Giannis rumors completely take over their franchise for what would you say? 2 months, 2.5 months here. It's been super awkward. Giannis has been just completely angsty all season long. I felt like if you go back to 2018, 2019, 2020, he was one of the best leaders in the NBA in terms of empowering his teammates, following his coaches. I thought he had a good bond with Coach Bud. Defensive intensity, night in, night out. That's what you wanted to see. I don't really recognize this current version of Giannis, who's making, you know, sniping comments after games. The Kalshi deal, that's super weird. Just like everything around him has been weird.
After the trade deadline?
Right.
What?
So are we going to get Giannis back, or is that Giannis gone for good? I mean, this is a team that kind of needs leadership, right? I mean, they could use him on the court. There's some debate. Are they going to shut him down or not? So obviously, you got to see if he's playing. But does he have any sort of a, you know, a bond with the teammates now that the cloud has been lifted, at least until the summer, right? Is he re-engaging? There was that clip going around. He's getting excited. Cam Thomas hits a shot. You know, Giannis is on the bench, you know, locked in. I want to see that, you know? That's kind of the vibe that I expect from him. And if it continues to be more weirdness or it continues to be, I'm just going to go out there and get 30 and 10, but I'm kind of checked out and I don't believe in this group and I'm throwing teammates under the bus and I'm, you know, kind of storming past Doc Rivers, then, you know, what does that tell you about what happens this summer? You know,
I think it's a great, great question with the Bucks, because even right now, like I posted the other day, the 9 teams that I felt were tanking, and Bucks fans are like, what are you talking about? We just won a game. Yeah. Like Cam Thomas went off. We're not tanking.
Yeah.
I was like, well, we'll see if you guys milk Giannis's return.
Right.
We'll see. I know you don't want him to rupture his Achilles. He's had a second calf injury and all that. But are they going to milk this until April? Is he just not going to play again ever? For the Bucks, is he even going to return? And if he does, to your point, Ben, what version of Giannis are you going to get?
So doesn't that make it worse? I mean, I understand why some guys get shut down, like Brandon Ingram in Toronto. It's like, okay, well, he did have some injury issues. There's the trade, so he hasn't been there. This is supposed to be like the most loyal guy in the NBA, one of the top 2 or 3 players coming into the season in the entire league. Can you imagine a scenario like a LeBron's getting shut down late in a season or Steph Curry is getting shut down for months at a time? I mean, I feel like at a certain level, when you get to superstardom, you get to first ballot Hall of Famer, you're NBA champion, MVP level guy, you should be above that, right? And if the front office, if I was Giannis, the front office came to me and said, hey, we saw what the Jazz are doing, looks pretty cool. I'd be like, no, sorry, I'm not going along with that. I'm going to play. And that's what I want to see from him. That's what I'm talking about with the leadership aspect. But, you know, money and politics, you know, that, you know, sometimes drives these decisions more than just personal pride and, you know, a long relationship with the fan base. It would be going out so sad if he's done as a Buck.
Unless Giannis is on the same page as the front office. And he's like, you know what? Ideally, I do want to stay here. And I know the best chances of me wanting to be here is us having
a great pick.
The second, third, or fourth pick in the draft.
So you're saying he's like the Pacers fans who want Zubac checked.
Exactly. 100%. Man. So maybe that's
this thinking
happening.
Has gone too crazy, KOC. We've had enough of it. Come on. Let's go play some basketball.
Let's move on to the Memphis Grizzlies. Yes. They've lost 4 in a row. They traded away Jaren Jackson Jr. Zach Edey, nowhere to be seen, being very conservative in his recovery. Ja Morant, we'll see if he ends up returning to the floor. They've lost 4 in a row entering the All-Star break. The thing I'm going to be watching with the Memphis Grizzlies is, what do we see from Cedric Howard?
Yeah.
What does his development look like in the second half of the year? Because statistically, he's scoring 1.15 points per isolation. Ooh. He's logged only 50 ISOs.
Yeah.
Not a lot of isolations, but that ranks 12th out of 172.
So give him the rock.
I want to see what happens with higher usage, higher volume Cedric Howard in the second half of the year, especially if you're not going to see Ja Morant and Zach Edey. So that's one of the things I'm watching for the Grizzlies is, what does their guy become that they valued enough to trade up for him and that we've seen so many flashes from in the first half of the year? What do we see from Cedric Howard? Does he pop?
So I love that one. Have you heard that phrase people say on Twitter or X? They say like the dynasty starts once this guy gets traded. Have you heard that? Like they brought up for like Golden State Warriors with Harrison Barnes. Yes. The Grizzlies dynasty starts when Ja Morant gets traded. I'm telling you, man, like I there's so much bad energy and juju around that group, but they're so good at drafting. They're so good at finding players. Cedric Howard's a really interesting guy.
Maybe the best in the NBA.
And I also think that they're kind of cutting edge in terms of in this crazy hyperspeed game, you have to have a lot of bodies. You can't play guys huge minutes. You have to have the shorter rotations. Like they're trying to do all that stuff. And Ja is the one who's like pushing back on it because it's not what he's used to. It's not what he's comfortable with. Well, Ja's been wrong about a lot. You know, I think these guys, their heads are in the right place. I think they're a pretty smart organization. And so whenever that trade happens, obviously it can't happen down the stretch of this trade deadline. But man, having that guy in place as you transition out of the Bane, Brooks, Morant, Jackson group, it's a really good place to start.
Who's your next team?
My next team's Dallas. Now, with Dallas, this is a little bit more off the court, but it starts with Cooper Flagg. I mean, I have been all in on Cooper Flagg probably since like halfway through his high school career, and every single step, he's exceeded the hype. You know, I'll never forget when he was at that USA basketball camp, and he's going end-to-end, and just the clips are just going insanely viral, and everyone's like, wow, we're looking at the future of basketball. He's been an absolute stud as a rookie. I thought Dallas should have been marked down as one of the big trade deadline winners because they just cut ties with Anthony Davis. And they said, hey, we don't want to have that energy around us anymore. We know we're ready to rebuild because we already have our guy. He's clearly going to be a franchise player. He's going to be all-star, all-NBA next year. No question about it in my mind. So with that being said, let's look at the front office. I think, you know, some of these reports, like does the ownership, are they interested in selling back to Mark Cuban and all that? I don't really see any of that kind of stuff happening, but I think you need to take the lesson from the Anthony Davis experience, which is if you clear out that bad energy, it's better for the fans. It's better for Cooper. Everything needs to be around what's better for Cooper. I would start fresh with the front office. I would go look for an outside hire. I would try to find somebody who's willing to make additional hard decisions in terms of like, does Kyrie make sense? Does Klay make sense? Do a lot of these older guys make sense? Or is it time to really pivot hard? And I think it's a good opportunity for the ownership group to win back some credibility, right? Everybody's putting these guys under the microscope because of how bad the Nico thing went, how horrible that Luka trade was. If you hire the right front office, they come in with the right message, you could spin this thing pretty quickly because you're going to have a guy next year, he might be a top 20 player. The year after that, he could be a top 5 to 7 player in the league, right? So leave the Luka stuff in the past. The easiest way to do that is get a new front office regime.
Cooper Flagg is, as of the past 3-4 weeks, probably one of the 30 best players in the NBA.
Yeah.
And that's not hyperbolic. It's not hyperbolic.
At 19.
And it's not hyperbolic for you to say what he could be next year or the year after that. He's on that trajectory. And I think with Cooper Flagg, the thing that's been pretty clear to me this season is that the ball handling improvement has raised his ceiling even higher than I think even Dallas could have anticipated when they took him number one. We knew he was a high floor player, at a minimum, could look like an all-star for a decade plus. We didn't know what the ceiling would be. Is it multi-time MVP? Is it all-NBA guy on the back end, third team? Well, I think this is a guy who has a chance to be a multi-time MVP. Yeah. So for Dallas to clean the slate, move on from AD, make it all about Cooper, it was one of the best decisions we saw of the trade deadline. And the Wizards get AD. They get Trae Young. Neither of those guys have played. There's mixed reporting around, will AD play? Will he not play and make his debut? I'd bet on no. Regardless of what happens with Anthony Davis and regardless of what happens with Trae Young, I'm wondering, is Trey Johnson going to have a moment? Because sometimes historically we see these scorers in their rookie season start a little slow. Like Anthony Edwards was a 15-point-per-game guy in the first half of his rookie season. Then the All-Star break happens. He averages 24, 25 points per game after the break, has 2 40-point games, 2 30-point games, going off almost every night. Trey Johnson is not Anthony Edwards. He's a different type of player. But he's such a high-intensity scorer, the ability to create off the dribble, the ability to get hot from three. I'm wondering, are we going to see a moment? Like, is Trey Johnson going to have one of those games where, like, whoa, this guy has a chance to be a superstar? And he hasn't had that yet.
Can he ruin the tank? You know, we talk about the tank commanders. They've got some guys on that roster that are pretty good tank commanders. But can he be a guy who has 40 on the wrong night against, you know, the Brooklyn Nets or whatever, and then all of a sudden it's changing your odds? I mean,
where Wizards fans are simultaneously happy and disappointed.
Yeah, mixed feelings for sure. But like, look, they need somebody who really hits, right? Sarr's been a nice player. Keyshawn George is an interesting player. They're starting to kind of get something coalescing. You know, you mentioned Trae Young and Anthony Davis probably not playing. Let's not forget D'Lo. That's another guy. God, you know, yeah, they have a big three of guys who aren't taking the court. It's kind of crazy to think about a weird spot to be in. And it's also, I mean, that could be something the NBA should be taking a look at, too. It's like just making deals with guys. They can stay home. It's like, what? You know, we're all supposed to be basketball players. These guys are all under contract. So what's happening there? You know, I'm not sure it needs to be sanctioned, but, you know, it's an unusual arrangement, you know, for how Washington and D'Angelo Russell are proceeding right now. You know, I think this is, man, they need to win it this year. Washington's come so close on the lottery, like within one ping pong ball multiple times. They almost got Wemby, very close to Cooper Flagg. Is this the year the karma smiles on them? You know, I don't know. You could really picture DP in a Wizards jersey, you know, is the kind of a little bit of like super athletic
very
guard,
possible.
You know, a little, not like a John Wall type, but like that kind of impact where, okay, this is now the city's guy. Everybody gets his jersey. He doesn't have to dance before the games, but like he's the franchise, right? That's what they really need with the pieces that they've already collected. It's just that main guy. And they'll be crossing their fingers on draft lottery night.
We've covered seven tanking teams so far. We have the Nets and the Kings remaining. I'll take the Nets. They're 15-38 this year. They stink. They've won a handful of games. They have some competitive players and all that. Yegor Demin, their rookie, being one of them. 39.6% from three this year on 6.4 attempts per game. Nobody's done that before, except for Keegan Murray. Keegan Murray shot the hell out of it his rookie season with the Sacramento Kings, has not shot nearly as well in the time yet.
Well, he was like 25, too. I mean, so let's give Igor his love, right? You know, he's doing it a little younger.
And that's the one, the question on my mind. Does Yegor continue shooting the hell out of the ball? Because he made only 27% of his threes at BYU.
Yeah.
He was not a knockdown shooter. He was very streaky. I want to see if he can finish the year out like this.
Yeah. I mean, making the jump as a three-point shooter is like the single most valuable thing you can do, especially if you have other, you know, interesting skill sets, which that's sort of why he was drafted. It wasn't the shooting stuff at all. It was like, hey, his size, his passing ability, you know, versatility and that kind of stuff. You know, I don't have a lot of good things to say about the Nets, though. I mean, they came here to L.A., and I want to say they got down like 42-14 against the Clippers, and it was like this team had quit, you know, within 1 minute of the game, and you could just see their coaching staff ripping their hair out. It's been a long season for Brooklyn. And, you know, speaking of long seasons, I'll wrap this up. The Sacramento Kings. And I spent a good chunk of my drive over here trying to come up with something to watch about the Sacramento Kings. I mean, they're an easy target. Kicking them while they're down, it's not super fun. But this might be my least favorite core group ever assembled. I mean, it's way up there. Like Westbrook, DeRozan, Zach LaVine, like three guys I just would not want to start my team with. And they're all together and they're all, you know, playing about as poorly as you would hope, you know, clearly in some cases years past their prime. I think if you're a Kings fan, what you need to do is not watch another second of the Kings this season. What you need to do is hop on Keon Ellis, and now he's on the Cavaliers, and just kind of, you know, secondary joy, you know, getting to watch this guy who you did like when he was in Sacramento get a chance at a playoff run and have a chance at an impact. I mean, you look at his minutes since the trade, he's getting a lot of time. They had the little rematch game where Cleveland was playing in Sacramento. He went off for like 20. That had to feel great, especially after getting buried behind all these veterans.
By multiple coaches,
too. By everybody. Nobody liked him except for the fans who were completely right about Keon Ellis. So I'm saying just forget about Vivek, forget about the coaching staff, forget about all these old veteran players who don't make sense and are probably going to be gone in the future. And just bandwagon Keon Ellis on the Cleveland Cavaliers playoff journey and have a good time that way. What do you think?
I love the idea. It's 100% true. That's what Kings fans should do. And also, Vivek might, you know, see the ratings dropping, be like, why is this happening? You're not interested in watching DeRozan and Russell Westbrook?
No,
we're not. We want to watch Nick Clifford. We want to watch Maxime Reynaud. That's what we want to see. We want to see the kids play. Because that's the funny thing with Sacramento. They have a core of veterans that makes no sense.
Yes.
But the young players are promising.
Bad.
But Keon Ellis was part of that. He's 26. It's not like he's old. And yet, here we are.
Well, wasn't that the takeaway, though, from last year's finals? Didn't smart organizations look at all the dogs, defensive, you know, perimeter dogs on Indiana and Oklahoma City and say, hey, you need a whole stable of this type of player. You know, you need to be able to grind people up. If you have to play full court in the finals because you're going after lead ball handlers, trying to wear them down, if you're trying to get Anthony Edwards exhausted in the Western Conference Finals, you want four different guys you could throw on him. I'm not saying Keon Ellis is going to be all defense or anything like that.
But he's one of them.
But
he's one of your guys.
Exactly. If you're trying to look at their group and say, hey, could you ever imagine them being a successful playoff team? Of all the guys on that team, he might be the top guy in terms of actually fitting a clear need for this modern game. And he's the guy who goes out because you're trying to get off contract. It's crazy. And that's why I say, like, go on strike, Kings fans. Like, I mean, come on. Like, because Kings fans know basketball, you know, yeah. And they've been showing up
one
for years.
One of the most passionate fan bases in the league.
And I was there for the Beam Team playoff run. I mean, that was a crazy series against Golden State. The electricity in that building when they got up early in that series was phenomenal. And so this idea now that, like, oh, well, we just have to watch somebody have success 2,000 miles away. It's the best they got. And by the way, I think they're undefeated, Cleveland is, since making the moves for Harden and for Ellis. So, you know, why not?
It was a brilliant deadline for the Cavaliers. I think they moved to the top of the East. We'll see if Tatum returns for Boston and how they can compete, obviously, the Knicks as well, and among other teams in the Eastern Conference. But, Ben, it's going to be an awesome second half of the year. People can hear your podcast, Greatest of All Talk. You and Andrew Sharp. I look forward to seeing you start and writing again soon, Ben.
Thanks, man. Great to be here.
Thank you for coming on. Big thanks to Ben Golliver for joining me. Coming up now, we have Cedric Howard from the Memphis Grizzlies. Joining me from the Memphis Grizzlies,
Cedric Howard.
Yeah. How you doing, Cedric?
I'm good, and yourself?
We last talked, I think, in May at the NBA Draft Combine. Great conversation about your journey up to the NBA, all the ups and downs you went through. And I'm happy for you, man. It's very cool to see the way your year's gone so far with the Grizz.
Appreciate it.
It's pretty awesome. I mean, you played six games at Washington State, and then a year later, you're named to the Rising Stars team. You're like a no-doubt first-team all-rookie in my eyes. I mean, is this happening sooner than you could have expected, getting so comfortable in the NBA?
No, I think, like, God's timing is always right. Whether it's soon to others or late to someone else, you know, for me, it's just, you know, the timing of it all is, I think, in just the right spot. Like you said, like, it's a long journey that I had to go through just to get here. And it's an even longer journey I have to go through to get to where I want to be and to stay there. So it's just beginning.
I mean, I think there's kind of like one of the things that I took away from our conversation last year was a level of wisdom you have in understanding how everybody's path is so different, and your path was your path. Yep. And even today, you're sitting here, all the success you've had so far in the first handful of months of your NBA career, and you're acknowledging, like, this is still just the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's early on now. Has your mind changed at all? Like, has the level of confidence increased?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been extremely confident in myself and extremely confident in what I can do. It's even better when you go out there and you can actually do it. You know, talk is just talk. You know, they say actions speak louder than words. So for me, being a basketball player and, you know, like I said, going through what I went through, even though, you know, I talk confidently or, you know, I have the wisdom, you still got to go out there and show it on the court. Now, if I was averaging a point and no rebounds, now, you know, I mean, like, it's a different conversation. But at the same time, for me, it's just like you said, it's always just making sure you maintain the confidence, whether I've had the successes, as you mentioned, or even the failures. I've had plenty of failures so far, too. So just making sure you take them all the same.
What's a failure you learned from?
We played Boston in Boston, and the whole film was just like bad, very bad. I'm not going to go into detail, but I was called out on the film, and that was like the moment I realized, like, that was a big failure of mine, just not only to my team, but also like to myself and what standard I hold myself to. So it was a well-deserved call out. I learned a lot from it, and vowed to make sure it didn't happen again.
How do you deal with criticism like that from a coach? Is it in the moment, how are you feeling when that's happening and the film's on screen?
Yeah, man, I think it's you listen more to the message and not the tone of the message. I mean, for me, whenever you're getting called out, I think it's actually better to get called out than to not, because it shows not only the care factor that a coach has for you and the standard they hold you to and the team to, but it also shows that, like, they're not, like, you're not worried about getting your feelings hurt. Like, they're not worried about hurting my feelings. And that's something I love about our coach. Like, he's not really worried about hurting your feelings. He's going to tell you, shoot it to you straight. And for me, like, I've always thrived under coaches that do that. You know, shoot it to me straight. Even if it's something I don't want to hear, obviously, you know, nobody likes to get called out. But at the same time, like, for me, it's just learning. It's always learning. Like, I never take it as bad as it is, but it's also never as good as it is as well. So for me, It's just making sure you learn from each and every call out, each and every time like I'm celebrated. You know, you're learning from all that stuff.
You had 27 points in your third game. Mm-hmm. Perfect three-point shooting night. I was like, damn. Like, I love Cedric Howard. I was a fan of you prior to the draft. I had you ranked very highly. That came sooner than I anticipated. How big was that 27-point game for you, for your confidence level? What do you remember from that night?
Oh, man, it was great. The biggest thing I would say was I couldn't shoot a lick in preseason. So in preseason, I was like, dang, I couldn't hit nothing. And then my first game, I didn't shoot any threes. I shot one, but I got fouled, so it didn't count. And then but the Pacer game was like, the ball just kept coming to me. And I was like, okay, well, one, thank you, my teammates, give me the rock. But at the same time, once the first one drops, like, I was like, okay, we're good. We're good to go. Then the second one, then the third one. And then you get to like this mode where it's kind of like unconscious. Like, it feels like practice in a way. It was just like every time I shot it, it was like I was outside playing on just like my mini hoop, you know what I mean, outside in the front yard. So for me, it was extremely high for my confidence, especially what I went through in preseason. Like with not hitting a shot and shooting a very low 3-point percentage. But it also, I think, gave my teammates confidence too. Like, damn, he probably can shoot. You know what I mean? So, you know, we should get him the ball. But at the same time, I'm not going to say I expected that, but it wasn't like super surprising either. It wasn't like
who's
a shock.
Who's the toughest guy that's defended you so far?
That's defended me?
Yeah.
Ooh. Jaden McDaniels is really tough. I mean, he's 6'9 and got a lot of length. And honestly, he's very disruptive. And honestly, Amen Thompson, too. Like, his defensive skills, obviously first team all defense last year, his defensive skills are like, his instincts are what is very challenging to get past, because he's not going to, like, he'll gamble, but it's not gambling. Like he'll go for a steal and then you'll be like, oh, okay, I got him. Like you have most guys. But then again, he's still there in front of you because like he understands like, all right, if I don't have a chance to get this, I can still recover back. Or if I, you know, jump on this pump fake, like I can jump in a way to where I can still get out the way. You know, he's like super skilled defensively, has a super high defensive IQ. And then there's a lot more other guys that I'm not mentioning. I mean, Lu Dort, super physical, you know, and many others. Like even from the Hornets, like, I mean, Brandon Miller is pretty good defensively too. I think, like you said, like those guys that are long, you know, tall and strong, like, you know what I mean? It's those are probably the most challenging defenders.
It's a different caliber of defender than you really play on a night to night basis at the college level.
Yeah.
And they're there on every team. Every team has a guy like that in the NBA.
Yeah.
And for you, like, what's something you learned from one of those tough defensive matchups?
Just to keep it simple, I think, like, the biggest moment I've learned that was when we played OKC at home, last possession, Caruso put me in a box, you know, and I was too complicated in what I was trying to do. So for me, like, I wish I can get that moment back. I know I'll have that moment again. It might not be against Caruso, but I know the moment will come again. And honestly, just to keep it simple, like, to go get to your spot and get to what you're comfortable doing and not really worrying about what they're going to do. Because their job is just to make you shoot something you haven't shot before, or, you know, get a poke on the ball or do something that just takes away your comfort. So for me, it's just to keep it simple, you know, not do anything crazy. And two, also, like, get the matchup I want. You know, I'd rather go against somebody else other than Caruso on that Thunder team. I mean, they're all filled
with
great,
right?
Yeah, they're all filled with great defenders, but at the same time, it's probably a better matchup for me.
the other side of that, who's the hardest guy that you've had to defend?
I mean, Shea and Luka are always tough to defend. Like, you can know what's coming, and at the same time, it's like, still, you can't stop it. And Edwards was really tough because he's super explosive. So it's like, with the Shea and Luka, they're so methodical in what they're going to do. Like, they can hit you with so many different moves, but they don't have, like, as quick an explosive step as Ant does. Ant will hit you with a whole bunch of different moves and then come down the next time and you're expecting him to hit you with the same whole bunch of different moves, but just do a tween and go. And you're like, oh, damn. Like, and his first step is so fast that it's, like, super hard to get back in front. And obviously, he can jump out the gym. So, you know, I feel bad for the big men. You know, I'm putting on an island there. But at the same time, there's so many different guys. I mean, Sadiq Bey is one that's, like, very underrated. probably Bay. In the league. Yeah,
it's not the name I would have anticipated.
Sadiq Bey is a bucket. Like, he's super strong, knows how to use his body, gets to his spots. And every time he's played us, he's had a really, really good game. So just making sure, you know, there's so many others. Like, but those are probably the toughest so far.
You defended Kawhi for 41 possessions, LeBron for 40, KD for 35, Steph for 25, SGA for 22. Those are some of your most common matchups you had this year on the defensive end of the floor. You've defended some of the biggest names in NBA history, former MVPs, champions. It feels like the Grizzlies have really put you out there defending different types of players, different shapes and sizes of players, different styles. What have you learned defensively in your experience this year with the different types of players you've defended?
Yeah, you learn your strengths and your weaknesses. I know definitely one of my weaknesses, or I wouldn't even call it a weakness, one of the things I can definitely get better at is like ball screen defense and not getting hit by screens. You're playing with centers who are the best screeners in the world. And even if they're moving, they're not moving. You know, unless it's called, they're not moving. So, and then you're also playing with these elite guards that can set up screens like the best in the world. But at the same time, also like with my length and, you know, I'm pretty strong. I can get stronger, but I'm pretty strong. I'm able to guard the guys like Bron, the guys like Luka, the guys like Kawhi, you know, the guys that are maybe a little thicker and you know, heavier in the body. But at the same time, it's like all the different matchups that you come against, like all those guys you named, they all have their own play style. They all are super efficient in what they do. They're not going to go away from what makes them successful. So you have to really dive into the film, dive into what, you know, is going to make you successful defensively against them. Like Bron is ambidextrous, so he can go left and right. So what you try to do is make him settle for fadeaway jumpers, fadeaway middies. And if he makes them all day, then you just got to live with it. It's kind of the same thing with Shea. You don't want him to get in the mid-range. I mean, he's shooting a three ball so much better this year, but you'd rather live with him shooting 10 step-back threes than 10 pull-up middies. You know what I mean? So I know the analytics are saying different.
For now.
But but at the same time, it's like you have to take away their comfort, like I said before. But at the same time, be willing to live with them making tough shots, because it's going to happen. Like, I mean, the first time we played Luka, he killed us on step backs. Like, and that's his go-to shot. We'll be right there in his face and we'll turn around, the ball's going through the net. So it's like you have to be willing to kind of live with that. But at the same time, if you dive into the film, you dive into all these things that you'll be successful.
You mentioned analytics. I have some stats for you. The Grizzlies this year, when you run in isolation, are scoring 1.15 points per isolation. That you've only logged 50 of them. It's not a lot, but of the 172 players to log 50 isolations, that ranks 12th of 172 in efficiency. So that's a great number. It's only 50, but so it's a small sample here. But I am curious, in your early experience operating out of isolations, one-on-one situations, what do you feel like you're already doing well? What are the things that you feel like you need to improve at in that isolation?
Yeah, I'm doing well when I keep it simple. When I just understand who I'm being guarded by, what like my advantage is. Like if I'm being guarded by a guard, my advantage is my size, you know, being able to shoot over them too, like if I need to, and get into the rim. Now, if I'm being guarded by big, you don't want to challenge Gobert at the rim. I mean, you can blow by him and use your speed, but at the same time, him being 7'1", 7'2", he may be able to recover. So that might be a time where you can gain separation to shoot step backs or whatever it may be. So it's kind of analyzing who you're being guarded by. But it's also understanding, too, like just where the space is. I think like if you have a lot of space on the right, it'd be dumb to go left. So you're understanding the space on the floor. And then, like I said, who you're being guarded by.
Is that I mean, it sounds like you're describing like rock, paper, scissors, the way like you're assessing.
It's a game within the game. That's what they always say. It's like a chess match. So when, you know, if they move a certain chess piece somewhere, you got to move it until you know counter it.
You've also run 389 pick and rolls this year, pretty high number. And with you pre-draft, one of the things you and I talked about, I believe, was working on your handle and continuing to improve that. I feel like the Grizzlies have thrown you out there, given you a lot of creation responsibilities. How much do you think your handle has improved in the past year since going back to college, or even the past 2 years from where you are today compared to where you were?
It's improved a lot. Definitely can improve a lot more. Mm-hmm. I think one of those things that like going through those pick and roll situations, I'm really comfortable coming off of the pick and roll. Now it's being comfortable coming off the pick and roll and seeing three options instead of seeing two options, you know, or four options, actually, because now you have strong side, you have the weak side corner, you have the lob, and you have your scoring opportunity.
Is that film study? Like, how's that improvement?
It's film study, and it's just reps. Mm-hmm. I think, like, one of the biggest things I saw in this summer was when we were playing before Ty got hurt in the preseason. Ty was playing, and he would dominate the pick and roll. And I remember I asked him, I was like, dude, like, how? Like, damn, how? You know, because every other possession, like, it would kind of look like that for me. But then some possessions, I got to get off it really early. So I would ask him, like, I asked him, I asked Ja, Scotty, like, all the guards we had, I would ask him, like, when you come off the pick, what is your first thought? Like, what is your first thing? And honestly, Ty just told me, he was like, look, well, first, you got to look to score, because they're not going to stop you, go score a bucket. And then two, now you understand what your options are. You understand where players are supposed to be on the floor. And like you said, it's just the reps of it. Like, if you're not practicing it, it's not going to be successful in the game. But if you are practicing it, if you're practicing understanding where guys are supposed to be, it kind of becomes second nature.
Is there a play in the pick and roll that you have in mind where you're like, I nailed that? Like, that was my best possession in the pick and roll.
I think we were playing the Pelicans. Yeah, it was the Pelicans. And I came off of a screen. And I threw a lob to Zach, I remember, because Derek Queen stepped up, but he didn't step up enough to where, like, he was like, it was like an easy lob. But he stepped up just enough so Zach could get behind him, or I can, you know, go. But at the same time, we have a 7'4" guy on your team, you throw that up. So, but it was significant because I remember in shoot around, we ran the kind of the same set in a way against our coaches. And I messed it up, and I threw Zach a bounce pass. And you're not supposed to do that with a 7'4" guy. So I remember that, like, in that situation, late in game, throwing that lob, just making sure it was, like, the best possible option. And to be able to succeed in that was pretty dope.
I'm missing watching Zach ED right now.
Yeah, it's Zach, awesome. The big dog, man. That's my guy.
I mean, how cool is it? Like, it's so often, like, in college football or college basketball, mm-hmm. where sometimes the best player in the game doesn't translate in their pro mm-hmm. league. But Zach Edey, with all the questions people had about him out of Purdue, he's translated. Yep. He's a big-time player on both mm-hmm. ends of the floor. I'm interested in your thoughts on him defensively. Yeah. Because at Purdue, 5 fouls in college, mm-hmm. you know, you can't foul out. But immediately in the NBA, he's become an enforcer. How would you describe playing with Zach Edey behind you, enforcing your defense?
I'll say, with Zach behind us, it gives us more confidence to pressure the ball more. And it gives us more confidence. If you do get blown by, it's not going to end badly most of the time. I would say our job is to not put him in that position. We shouldn't put him in a position where, like, oh, well, we got Zach down there. That's not it at all. But it gives us more confidence. Like, I know if we guard our guy the best possible, even if he does get downhill, because it's going to happen, we have the big dog in the back to, you know, clean up the rest of the mess. But for him, it's always, like you said, it's the work he's put in. Like, I see it now. Like, when he did come back and was playing, he's obviously most of the time in the drop coverage. But even if we needed him in an up coverage, he would translate that quick and understand, like, okay, look, I understand my archetype, my body, and I'm not going to just come up here and, you know, try to steal the ball or try to swipe or anything, but I'm just going to disrupt everything possible, use his size.
I mean, long term, the Grizzlies could have an elite point of attack defender, elite wing defender on you, mm-hmm. an elite guy at the rim, Zach Edey.
Let's go two elite point of attack defenders, Jalen Wells.
Sure, Jalen yeah. Wells as well. I mean, very good player. I mean, I think you guys are building something. It's a young team, obviously. Mm-hmm. Some controversy this year with John. Mm-hmm. Jaren Jackson gets traded and all that. What's it like for you being in it, in a locker room, experiencing this rather than seeing it from afar on social media and all that?
It's actually surreal. I think it's like one of those things where it was a very emotional time, you know, like Trip, Vince, Jiddy, and Jock all leaving. Like, all of them meant something to me in different ways. And we built relationships. Like, Trip was like my first vet, really. Like, he's dropping knowledge on me all the time and stuff like that. So it was definitely emotional, but at the same time, being in it, it kind of gives you an understanding of the business. Like, this is kind of like, as much as I hate to say it, this is the new wave of, you know, we have to move past those guys in a way. They mean so much to me, you know, they're my brothers for life, but at the same time, it is like, now that they're gone, you have to move on to the next step. You have to move on to the next, you know, phase of, I guess, the Grizzlies, you know, generation, and you're trying to build a new culture and build chemistry with these young guys. Like you said, the young core, I think it's super positive too that they believe in us that much to be able to do make a move like this. But at the same time, like you said, we just have to do our part and, you know, make them look pretty smart.
I mean, that's one of the things I'm excited for with you with the second half of the year. And I'll bear the whole team is seeing how these guys develop, how seeing how you develop. And one of the things that I'm looking up numbers about you and rewatching some of your stuff to prep for our conversation. And one of the things that kind of surprised me, and I sort of felt it just watching, but diving into the numbers, your success with unassisted versus assisted chances. Unassisted, you have a 55.8 effective field goal percentage. That ranks 13th out of 127 players. That's in the same ballpark as guys like Luka and Fox and Mitchell and Reeves. And obviously different players, different play types. On assisted chances, you're shooting only 51.7%. That's in the third percentile of players. That's in the league of Marcus Smart and Dyson Daniels, some less efficient players. You've had great success in self-created chances, less efficient in assisted chances. And that's surprising to me, considering you're a good cutter, you're a great spot-up shooter in the college level. I'm just curious about your general thoughts on how the unassisted opportunities you've really thrived in have been ahead of those other opportunities where the ball has been thrown to you on catch and shoot opportunities and all that.
Yeah, I would say like most of it is probably just me just making the shot. You know, I would say my teammates do a really good job when I do shoot and they put me in assisted situations that like they put the ball in my pocket and stuff like that. I just have to do my job and make the shot, whether it's off a cut, whether it's off a catch and shoot, whatever it may be. If you like ran all the clips, I can tell you exactly why I missed or why you know, it is lower. But the unassisted point is like, I think you when you're in a situation like that, when you're in a self-creation situation like that, all you're trying to do is get to the shot that you practice the most or the shots that you'll be most successful that has a chance to go in. I don't know why it's lower. I wish it was, you know, I wish they were both high, but at the same time, you know, it's just something to work on. I'm glad you told me that.
Well, you're shooting 42% on pull-up threes and 32% on catch-and-shoot threes and small samples
here. Yeah, it's it'll get higher.
Yeah, it'll get higher over time. And I think it is also worth mentioning offensive rebounds are part of the unassisted. If you remove those, you're in the 73rd percentile, which is still very good compared to the 90th percentile. With the offensive boards, that is a strength, though, as a wing player to be able to attack the boards, create second chance opportunities on the defensive end of the floor, and obviously rebounding as well. I'm curious for you, rebounding, is this just all pure instinct, or is there any element of like thinking about the side of the court where the player is shooting from and knowing there's a higher probability of it going in a certain area?
It's both. I think like if somebody shoots a three, most of the time the rebound's going to be long because it's going to either hit back rim and go long or one of the side rims and go, you know, each direction. The only chance is probably if it hits front rim and like goes straight down or like front rim and like bounces off the back rim and like, you know, it loses a lot of the speed of the ball, I guess. But it's understanding like long shot, long rebound. Short shot most of the time is short rebound. Also understanding if it's shot from the left side, you know, say if we're playing, like I know Cam's the best shooter on our team. Cam shoots a lot of left-handed pull-ups. Like, and so most of the time he's on the left side of the floor. Like if Cam shoots it, the way he shoots the ball, most of the time it's either hitting front rim or back rim. So it's probably going to go back to the left side. Meanwhile, if, you know, sometimes I'll shoot the ball and say it goes to the left side, or I'm shooting from the left side and it hits the left rim, maybe it goes to the right. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of understanding who you're playing with, who's shooting. But at the same time, most of it's instincts. Most of it's just like see ball, get ball. Like if you have a chance to go get an offensive rebound and create another possession for the team, you should go do that. And a part of it is also like following our principles at the same time. So make sure you're not gambling for the offensive rebounds. Now you're getting put in what we call chaser situations. So now it's like 5-on-4 the other way. And, you know, they're in a fast break and now you get scored on. So
what have you enjoyed about living in Memphis?
Just living in a new city, man. I mean, it's really good to see the amount of people that support the Grizzlies out there. Obviously, we're the only thing in Memphis, but at the same time, the fans are really good. They're really good people. I walk around Walmart, Costco, and, you know, I get stopped all the time. But people are always telling me, like, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad, you know, I'm glad Memphis got you, you know. And to say, you know, I may be reading more into it than what they're saying, but to say Memphis got you, I think that's a good thing. They may just be talking about the Grizzlies and using the location. But at the same time, it's like understanding like how much the city appreciates it is really cool.
I mean, I know in my time, like there, I visited twice. It's a very tight community. Mm-hmm. It's all about the Grizzlies. There's a real passion for the team there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a smaller market, but I feel like the team feels huge there. Mm-hmm. Have you hit the music scene at all? I mean, you mentioned like the Grizzlies are the main thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, you hitting music scene at
all? Not really. I'm not big into music. My dad is. My dad's a musician. So, I mean, he's definitely
what does he play?
Embarking. Mainly the drums, but he's like one of those musicians that's like, if you gave him a week to learn an instrument, he'll learn it fully. So it's like one of those. But at the same time, like I haven't indulged so much in the music, but I know about it. So it's something I'll definitely indulge in more and, you know, hopefully get a lot more information about.
I mean, when your dad comes visiting, I don't know if he's living there or anything, but when he visits, take him to a jazz club or something.
Yeah, man,
like
he'd just be walking around sometimes. Like I know he found a cigar shop that he likes to go to out there. So he'd just be walking around doing his own thing at times. So he's probably seen more stores than I have, honestly.
I mean, the Grizzlies were very aggressive in getting you in the draft. They wanted you. When did you know Memphis wanted you?
Draft day.
Yeah, no hints.
I left. So the Grizzlies are my last workout before the draft. And when I went there, obviously you talk to the GM in the front office the day before and the day of the workout. I talked to them in the morning. I worked out. I remember Tomas, I talked to him one time and it was to ask him a question about a ghost screen. And because like usually ghost screens, you open up. He didn't want to open up. He just wanted kind of the sprint because there's more space. He went into detail why. And I was like, okay, cool, great. But I didn't like have no sit down with him, nothing. And I left thought I did really good in the workout. I was like, yeah, man, I killed that workout. That was pretty good. But then I was like, but I didn't talk to nobody. So it was like, there's no shot. There's probably no chance, right? And they're at 16. So I don't know. Yeah, there's no shot. So I go draft day, honestly thinking like, nah, no Grizzlies, no, you know, that's not even in the cards. I wasn't even paying attention to that. And then I see my agent on the phone while Adam Silver's walking to the podium. And it says the Trailblazers. I was like, I didn't even work out for the Trailblazers. What the heck is going on? And then my agent comes up to me. He's like, look, it's the Grizzlies, not the Trailblazers. Wow. They traded up. And I was like, oh, snap. And when that happened, like the first feeling was just like I got drafted. But then I was like, dang, to the Grizzlies is wild because, like, I didn't talk to the head coach, you know, like, I talked to the GM and, you know, the front office earlier. Yeah, but I didn't, like, have no sit down, nothing. So it was, like, super interesting. But then I got on the phone with them after and, like, to see their excitement, their belief in me was super awesome.
I mean, it's interesting, probably because they didn't need to talk to you. They knew the intel was all good, personality-wise.
Yeah, I'm glad.
It was like, we don't need to talk to this guy. There's other guys you want to talk to, but not Cedric Howard.
I'll take that reputation.
Well, did you learn anything about what they liked about you after that? I mean, what did they say?
Yeah, man, just the amount of, like you said, obviously the good personality, the good attitude, the good background, because they do way more background check than what you may think. But honestly, just the way I play, I think they're like the grit I came with and, you know, not to like use a pun, but the grit and grind I had in like my journey of going
perfect
to the league was perfect for how they wanted to play and how Tomas wants to have his team and, you know, have just the culture build in Memphis, which is good. And it's still an opportunity, like you said, to keep building upon that.
And last thing, Cedric, what's one goal you have for the remainder of the season?
Just to keep getting better, man. Just to keep getting better, to stamp not only my skills and development on a league, but also stamp our team on the league. Like, understand, like, we may be going through whatever we're going through right now, whether you want to call it a rebuild or, you know, a transfer to the new generation or whatever it may be. But at the same time, it's not going to be long. It's not going to be long.
Cedric, you know I'm rooting for you, man. Thank you so much for coming
on
today. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Big thank you to Ben and Cedric for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Brett and Sarah here in Los Angeles for producing these episodes. Thanks to Emmy, as always, and the whole staff for producing my show. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music, and I hope you enjoyed giving us a listen. We got a lot planned for this week on the Kevin O'Connor Show, so stay tuned this week and next week with a bunch of the conversations we recorded here in Los Angeles at All-Star Weekend. Have a good one, everybody. We'll be back again very soon.